Good morning, everyone. I'm going to bring the meeting to order so we can move forward and leave at a good time. I'm Representative Johnson, the chair for the Telecom Reagan Infrastructure Division, and thank you all for being here. This is obviously the cream of the crop of legislators, and you should be very proud to be a part of this committee. Thanks for being here. I think we'll start off by just briefly going through some introductions. Start with legislators ourselves. Again, I'm Representative Johnson. I represent east side of St. Paul, Battle Creek neighborhoods in my fourth term. I've sat on Regulated Industries a couple of times now and becoming more and more informed about this very important industry, so I'm very pleased to have the opportunity to chair it. And pass over to Paul here.
Paul Thiessen from Minneapolis. I also represent Richfield, and I was on Regulated Industries last year as well, and I look forward to working with everybody this year.
Good morning. I'm Mike Beard. I represent the good folks in Shakopee and Prior Lake, known as District 35A. Starting my third term, the first two terms, 4 years, I had the good fortune to serve on the old Regulated Industries Committee, which oversaw telecom issues as well. With my friend Representative Thiessen, we had a couple of fun bills the last few years that we tried to do bipartisanly and some telecom and cable issues. I specifically requested to be back on this committee with Representative Johnson chairing it and taking on telecom things because I think there's a lot of room for us to impact the future economy, economic growth of our state on a statewide basis. I'm looking forward to that. Mr. Johnson, I'm glad to be here.
Thank you.
Good morning. I'm Ron Szymanski. I represent District 18A encompassing McLeod County and portions of Meeker County. And I'm a freshman legislator, but I do represent a somewhat rural area and just wanted to be involved in the telecommunications in outstate Minnesota. So I'm proud to be here.
Representative Al Junkie, 13B, Wilmer in Candy Lake County. My voice is a little shot today. My home phone carrier is Quest. My cell phone carrier is Midwest Wireless. And my internet provider is Charter Communications. So we'll be looking for all those lobbyists during the session.
I'm Bill Hilty. My district is 8A, which is parts of Pine, Carlton, and St. Louis counties. I guess I have served on the old Regulated Industries Committee for 8 out of the last 10 years. Have been immersed in many of these issues and looking forward to continuing.
I'm Terry Morrow. I represent Nicoll County and part of Sibley County. And Al, I think you and I receive about the same number of telecom-related bills a month, so we should work together.
Good morning. I'm Sandy Mason. I am from 38A, which is basically the western portion of Egan and three precincts in Burnsville. I have long followed cable and actually had a cable television program at one point. And this area, I think, obviously is of interest to everybody. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. And also, I spoke with Representative Saylor last night, and she had an out-of-town meeting, couldn't make it today. That was previously scheduled way early, and I think Representative Hoppe is going to be joining us a little bit later. And we also have some fantastic staff that are working with us, and give an opportunity for them to say a few words about who they are and what they do here. And I'll start with Elizabeth.
Sure. My name is Elizabeth Emerson, and I will be the committee administrator for this division as well as the full Commerce and Labor Committee.
I'm Bob Eliff with the House Research Department, and this will be my fourth session dealing with telecom issues, and I'm going to figure it out yet.
Go ahead, Mary.
Good morning. I'm Mary Faust. I'm the committee legislative assistant, returning after 8 years. I worked for the majority leader, Ted Winter, when I left, and now I'm back and very happy to be here. If there's anything I can do to help any one of you, just call.
Very good, and we have some great research staff.
I'm David Sullivan with the DFL Caucus Research.
Ian Marsh, GOP Caucus Research.
And our pages, if you would introduce yourselves, please.
My name is Chris Farmer-Lease, and I'm temporarily serving this committee, and I'm actually kind of a telecom nerd.
Excellent.
My name is Wayne Chu, and I like him. I'm a temporary page on this committee.
Very good. Thank you very much. You received part of your packet, rules and procedures. It's pretty much boilerplate information. I'm not even sure I've read them thoroughly myself, but I think you have a fairly good sense of what the protocol is for committee meetings, and it's pretty much the same as ones you've seen throughout committees. The seating and so forth is all very informal. Given these Friday morning sessions, you're going to sit wherever you want. It certainly isn't any set place or anything like that. And I will note, we do have some coffee here. If you haven't helped yourself, please do so. Get some. Lastly, I'll add, I'm going to be meeting individually with members in the committee just to chat a little bit about what their interests are and the direction they may want to see the committee go. So if I haven't had a chance to talk to you, I will in the next week, and we'll just walk through some of the goals and objectives of this particular division. So with that, I think we're going to move right into the presentations from our state agency. First up, right out of the door, right to rock and roll, from the Department of Commerce. And if you'd introduce yourself when you're ready.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, thank you very much for this honor to let me present to you this morning. I'm Edward Garvey, Deputy Commissioner at the Minnesota Department of Commerce for Energy and Telecommunications. Joining me is a special assistant and adult supervisor, Diane Wells. Let me give you a very quick overview of the department, a little bit about myself, and then I'll sort of go into a very brief summary of, we'll call it 115, 120 years of telecommunications regulation and authorities, and where we are today and where we may or may not be going in the coming weeks and months and years. My division at the Department of Commerce has about 75 staff. Of that, 10 or so are devoted to telecommunications regulation and oversight. Most, if not all, of the work that we do is devoted to analyzing and overseeing utility telephone company filings and providing advocacy and public policy information to the Public Utilities Commission, to the governor, and to you, the legislature. Those folks are sometimes very, 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 very busy on very, very big deals, and other times just managing the day-to-day dockets. Let me sort of walk through some of the tremendous transitions that we've been going through over the last several years and how we got there. You know, about 1889 or so, Alexander Graham Bell, you know, identified that he could basically transmit voice messages over wires. Then over the subsequent 30, 40 years, an industry developed around that, and a lot of folks spent a lot of time and a lot of money stringing up wires to connect those. It turned out to be not the most efficient way of doing it. A lot of redundancy, a lot of overlapping, a lot of money wasted and expended. A lot of people left unserved. The conclusion was, we need to, even as the nation was trying to break away from trusts and monopolies, this is one industry that you need to monopolize, or at least allow for vertical integration. In return for that vertical integration authority, they became regulated. They became regulated at the state level, mostly, but also at the federal level. And that put in place an industry dynamic that was very, very stable, very, very effective, and provided tremendous service to the people of the United States for the next, 50 years. In the meantime, as part of that, industry stabilizes, the relationships between the companies, and I say companies, I mean there was, AT&T was far and away the biggest provider in the country, but there were many other companies in play, particularly in states like Wisconsin, Minnesota, and Iowa. States that developed small companies that provided small regional services, still incumbent local providers, but provided service nonetheless to those states. In that respect, we are relatively unique because we have a lot of small companies, small telephone companies. While other states, they're dominated by just two or three companies, we have almost 87, 86 local, independent, incumbent local exchange carriers, in addition to companies like Quest. All right. So you have the solidification of that. It works well. The relationships between these companies work well. The marketplace goes like this. Your local phone calls, your calls from your home to your neighbor, to your local businesses, inexpensive. Long-distance calls, expensive. They're using those to cross-subsidize. That's the way we want it because we wanted to maximize the interconnectivity at the local level. Folks look at that and sort of say there's money to be made in the long distance marketplace. Let's go challenge that and see if we can basically provide competition to that. This brings us into the 70s and early 80s. At that point, the federal government, the company, AT&T, works out a deal to break up the AT&T monopoly, particularly at the long distance level. They decide that competition can be provided for long distance service, but local service is still a monopoly. Still should be managed the way it had been done before. So all of a sudden you have the various breakups of the AT&T network. You have competition, AT&T, MCI, Sprint, etc., etc., coming into play in the 80s. And the regulatory outlook at that point is generally at the federal level, managing that interplay between those companies. Regulators at the state level are still managing the local incumbent providers and doing so the way they had done traditionally. A lot of things going on, a lot of plays, but you're starting to see the transition as the competition at the long distance level. Fast forward a decade. They realize, policymakers realize, the state of Minnesota realizes in the mid-1990s that you can have competition at the local level too. The state of Minnesota, 1995, a year in advance of the 1996 Federal Act, decided that competition at the local level was an appropriate public policy to pursue and put in place laws for state regulators to start to implement. And so what happened in the 1995, 1996 at the state level and then at the federal level for 96 was a directive to open up the local incumbent exchange carrier networks, particularly the biggest companies, particularly what is called in the acronym jargon the regional baby bells, U.S. West at that time, Quest today, because they were the biggest dogs and they were the ones that you opened up. The smaller companies, we could do it if you wanted to, but you didn't have to. In addition, you saw other competitors rise, Echelon, Integra, those kind of companies, McLeod, come up and sort of, these are competitive local exchange carriers. These are providers that sort of said, look, we can provide you local service. We can use our own network, we can use pieces of the incumbent's network, or we can just resell the incumbents network from a wholesale to a retail pricing arrangement. As you can imagine, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, that this was not easily done, nor was this uncontested. Because what the law asks the regulators, the department staff, the commission to do is set the rules of the road of how those competitors and those incumbents work with each other. Many of this, and this was occurring through the second half of the 90s and the first half of this decade, working out what were those relations, what was the pricing arrangements, what, under what conditions, what types of these facilities, and what types of terms and conditions would the competitor have to pay the incumbent? Did the incumbent have to offer to the CLEC? Lots and lots of issues, lots and lots of controversies, lots and lots of different perspectives that were sort of brought to bear and required regulatory intervention, arbitration, decision making, and just edicts in some settings. At the same time we were doing this, we need to make sure that everyone's systems worked, that the dial tone was provided to the consumers, that the networks were connecting to one another. You needed to make sure that the companies that were providing that service were getting fairly compensated for that. So this is a very, very complicated process. And we spent a bunch of time when I was at the commission. I was a member of the Public Utilities Commission for about 6 years. And that was a lot of my time. That was a lot of the commission's time. It was a lot of commission staff time. And the department's time was as the chief public advisor of that. In many respects, we're still working on a lot of those issues, and we're in like third or fourth generation of those kinds of questions. The questions between what I would characterize the wholesale marketplace of connecting, with how do these companies connect with one another? And you see filings from them that sort of say, the things that we interpreted, that you commissioned interpreted several years ago, aren't being applied appropriately. Or they need to be changed because events have turned. Or the issue that you didn't decide then because we didn't think it was important then is now important. And those kinds of things are still coming before the commission and my staff's analysis. And those are the kinds of questions that, in many respects, are best handled at this regulatory level. They're important public policy guidance, and you've given us that. But our message, your message is, the legislature's message, the law's message is, provide a fair but competitive wholesale marketplace where multiple providers can provide services to the people of Minnesota. At the same time, we start dealing with these issues and trying to get that marketplace between what arguably are the copper wire linkages. You have two tremendously important technological changes going on. You have the rapid rise of wireless providers, and you have the rapid rise of the speeding up of the ability to transmit data over those wires through broadband.
Let me just interrupt you for a second there, Commissioner. Representative Beard, I believe, has a question to testimony.
Please, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Garvey, maybe it would be helpful to just poke a little further at what originally cracked this monolith. Because for a century, as you described, we had a government-sanctioned monopoly in exchange for certain regulations and service requirements and so on. Can you describe just a little bit the environment, the dynamic around that caused a federal judge, I believe, to actually be on the point, to break up the bells and to break up the long lines division? And it wasn't just that, it was more to it than just MCI coming along and saying, hey, we can compete for this service. It wasn't there actually some federal court action that sort of was the dynamite, stick of dynamite that blew it apart and let things happen. In your opinion, talk a little bit about that and why a judge took us down that road. That would be helpful, I think, as background for where we are today.
Commissioner Garvey.
Mr. Chairman, Representative Beard, thank you very much. Just like you're getting sort of telecom 101 as seen through my, you know, jaded and relatively sort of, you know, ignorant eye. So
if he's got the charges extra for telecom 201, well, then we can wait until another meeting. But
go ahead, proceed.
Multiple things were happening, were going on. There was agitation from a number of providers of equipment, the telephonics equipment, that started believing that they could provide services that was better and cheaper and more efficient than the monopolistic AT&T. There was a recognition at the same time this was coming about that what I characterize candidly as the mother may I regulation of a lot of industries were also coming to an end. You saw it in trucking and banking and in railroads, and a lot of those kinds of things were also. So there was not only the rise of technologies and corporate business plans, but philosophical and approaches that were coming to a head. And the U.S. Justice Department concluded that AT&T monopoly or the monopoly wasn't necessarily the best approach in the long run, certainly on the long run. So there were a federal judge consolidated it, Judge Green in the U.S. District Court of the District of Columbia basically became a master of this, and ultimately a deal was cut between the Justice Department and AT&T on deciding whether they were going to cut up AT&T between long distance and local or long distance. They chose to break up at the AT&T decided to accept the breakup of at the long distance level and divest their local companies. And so you basically had seven regional Bell operating companies start across the country: Bell South, Southwestern Bell, U.S. West, which was a consolidation of Northwestern Bell and here. And you had Pactel, which is Nevada and California. You had Bell Atlantic, etc. And since then, you've seen the merger of those companies, of course, over the second half of the 1990s and the first half of this century, first half of this decade. The same kind of philosophies, in a very quick, as I give a very quick, and there are many people in the audience, and certainly Diane knows more about this than I do, but the same philosophical things, rising technologies, and a philosophical approach that a competitive marketplace offers the consumers better value for their money through better technological advances and different offerings so that they can choose. I mean, those kinds of things. And that's the law that this state of Minnesota adopted in 1995. That's been the policy driving the department's policy positions and the commission's decisions.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that very much.
All right, you're welcome.
At the same time, as I sort of walking through this, as these move, and you can sort of, you can sort of start, you can't really date them, but you sort of look back and sort of see these trends. The trends have been towards technological advances, choices for consumers, more business and different types of business models. At the same time, there's been an erosion of state regulatory oversight in favor of market approaches and the federal regulatory arrangements. Many of the current technological advances or technological approaches for providing information, communication, entertainment, wireless, high speed, are beyond the state's jurisdiction. Those kinds of questions. So, what in many respects we still have the very important regulatory role of managing the wireline telephonic interplay, but the wireless, even the high-speed DSL, is not in our jurisdiction. Some other technologies that are very, very important, the cable, the state does not have a direct regulatory role. The regulatory role is being handled at the local franchise community levels and at the federal government level. The state doesn't have a role in that. We have a role if they want to play as a provide services as a competitive local exchange carrier and provide telephone service that way. They have some obligations in there. We have a system that's designed that regulation by technology, by legacy, not by what the services that they're providing, not by their impact on the consumer. And this is what makes this area so intellectually interesting from a policymaker perspective, so difficult from a regulator's perspective, from a consumer's perspective. In many respects, they basically are getting the advantages and the disadvantages of this marketplace. They're getting an explosion of very, very creative and exciting technological opportunities that many are taking advantage of. At the same time, they don't necessarily have the same consumer protection mechanisms that they had before, but they have the choice opportunity of changing providers. And so this is going to be in the milieu that this subcommittee, which is a very, very exciting, actually have a subcommittee devoted to this issue, to sort of work through. Mr. Chairman, that sort of concludes my sort of 101 very quickly. I have a list of issues that I think it might be worthwhile to walk through that I think they're on my radar screen, but I'd also like to sort of give Diane an opportunity to basically correct anything that I've misstated, because that's generally the way we operate in the department.
Okay, thank you, Commissioner Garvey. Ms. Wells?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you know, he did a fine job explaining the history and why we are where we are today, which I think it's important to understand that history, because you'll see issues that you're like, why do we do things this way? But a lot of that is based on where it came from years and years and years ago. Thank you.
To give you a sense of where we are today, Mr. Chairman, we have 96 incumbent telephone companies that receive certificates from the commission and operate and regulate under Minnesota's traditional telephone service regulations. Most of them are in alternative form regulations, which means they're in a rate cap arrangement. We have 340 companies that are authorized to provide long distance. You know, many of them are the big ones that you know and you see advertised, AT&T, Sprint, Quest, MCI, etc. But they include the niche long distance providers, 360 Network, AceLink, Looking Glass Networks, I mean, something, Techstar Communications. Niche players, small players, they may not even be serving here, but they have 50 states authorization because that's the way they want to do it. We have 175 competitive local exchange carriers. Those are just the folks that we serve. Those are the competitors that are providing local service or authorized to provide local service. You know, the Echelon, McLeod, Prairie Wave, Covad, Integra, you know, XO, some of the cable companies. I mean, those are the choices. They each have individual service territories that they decide that they want. Only the incumbents have specific territories where they have to serve everyone in that territory. The rest can basically choose their service territories. They have to tell us where they are, but they can choose. I'll quickly walk through some of the issues that we're paying attention to. The common theme between most of these is that we don't have jurisdiction over them or regulatory authority within, you know, at least directly on point. We would be welcome to offer policy advice and guidance. We'll be monitoring them from a public policy point of view, and of course, on behalf of the the governor. But, you know, the one of them, Mr. Chairman, is you know, the bill that I think that you've introduced or are introducing. I haven't seen it, so I don't, you know, your cellular telephone Consumer Protection Act. I mean that wireless and how the relationship between wireless providers and their customers. That's one of the bills. There'll be several. We expect, or at least we think that there'll be discussions about further addressing the regulatory impacts of the state's regulation on incumbent carriers who are competing with carriers who aren't regulated similarly. The specific example is the limitation on some companies to have to be regulated if they're offering less than four business lines. This is in the 2004, which was the last piece of telecom legislation passed in the state of Minnesota. There was a permission for particularly a company like Quest, but any other entity providing services in a certain number of cities, in certain specified cities, to not be regulated for their provision of services of more than four lines to businesses. But some of those communities, for reasons that I don't completely understood at the time and I don't understand today, weren't given that opportunity. And there'll be some interest to do that. I know some of the other companies are trying to sort of also sort of try to look through the rules and regulations and identify other spots where they're being regulated differently than their competitors and maybe asking for legislative relief. There'll be the state level franchising of video service provider questions.
Commissioner, just so we're on the same page time-wise, you have about 10 minutes remaining, and then there'll be other opportunities for testimony, too, but just so you can put in context the rest of your presentation.
The funding of 911, Telephone Assistance Minnesota, which is, we have a extraordinary program that we serve multiple states across the country in providing service for those of hard of hearing. We call that TAM, the Telephone Access Minnesota. The funding of that, as well as our telephone assistance plan, which is a low-income program. How we fund those, making sure that they are adequately funded, whether or not those monies could or should be used for other sources. I urge you not to, but I know some sort of see them as funding sources. But The infrastructure questions, which of course is a charge of this committee, to look at the infrastructure question. An issue that we struggle with from the department's perspective and the public policy is you want to encourage the marketplace and you want to sort of avoid regulatory intrusion because of its unintended consequences. At the same time, we want to assure that there is a growth of infrastructure, provide ever expanding telephonic capabilities, and so how we do that. And those are the kinds of questions that we sort of struggle with, and I think that you guys are going to have to struggle with. And I look forward to watching you. It's very hard. Hard to figure out. It's hard to sort of figure out where you draw those lines. I can argue all sides, and I do with myself. So I can help you. The net neutrality. These are the kinds of issues you might be paying attention at the federal level about the questions of those. You know, there are many providers on how to that provide internet services and whether the neutrality of those and that kind of thing. Now, even that term is sort of laced with a pejorative that. It's difficult to sort of sort out what it exactly is, but it's one of those kinds of issues that I know that you may be paying attention to. On the infrastructure question, back is the rise of municipalities and providing Wi-Fi, WiMAX, and those kinds of services and capabilities for their constituencies. and the interplay between what they're proposing and the, you know, private sector's already invested in embedded services and those kinds of questions. The service provider data, and I'll sort of conclude with that in open questions. One of the casualties, if you will, of the changing in the marketplace is the department and the commission's ability to actually have hard, firm, strong, accurate, reliable data on what exactly is going on. How many people have access to high speed? How many people are actually taking high speed? Is an example. You know, but that information is has never been collected by us. We have no jurisdiction or authority to collect it, or the legislature has said that we don't need to collect it. And so one of the questions that you may end up having to sort of struggle with and ask me for and say, well, what is the data on us? How many do it? And I'm going to have to respond is, we don't know, we don't have that data, or the data that we have is, you know, it's 24, 36, 48 months old, which in this industry is obsolete data. And so that question mark is one of the ones that we struggle with from our side, and I think that the committee is going to have to struggle with as you think about your policy making decisions. Is there any other one that I've missed? There are a lot of other, I mean, there are lots and lots of little cats and dogs issues that I can bring to you. But I've tried to give you, for the sake of the time, just a little bit of the highlights.
I think, thank you, Commissioner. I think that's what we're looking for, is kind of the overview, and there'll be opportunities for us later on to provide further information. I have a question from Representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Garvey, on collection of data, it's certainly available from the independents. I see them out here. They come in our office. They lay down sheets of paper all the time. Here's how many of our households have high speed. Here's our coverage. So it's readily available, whether or not you collected it, I think. The question I have, obviously it's a concern of yours if you brought it up here, do other states' agencies have that data timely, up to date, and are you able to access it from other states rather rapidly so we have comparisons of Iowa, Wisconsin, you know, at least our neighbors and other Midwest states? Is it something you need, you think you should be able to obtain and work with and track?
Commissioner Garvey?
Mr. Chair, Representative Garvey, I'll give a quick overview and I'll ask Diane to sort of give the substantive response. It's not, I wanted to highlight it because as a rule, you like to always have accurate information before you make a decision. And it's hard to get accurate aggregate information. There is no question that the providers have this information. It's basically sort of making sure you're covering the state all-wide and not making a decision on anecdotal information on the basis of one provider's type of information, because a different provider may be very different. On one hand, when you ask the question, when I sort of said, it's nice to have more information, it's always nice to have more information. The question that we've been struggling with and the question the legislature struggled with is how do you gather that information without being regulatorily intrusive or imposing sort of costs? And there are some providers who don't need to respond because they have no jurisdiction and send a letter back saying, thanks very much, but this is proprietary information, we're not going to give it to the state. I mean, and that's their right under the, so it's that kind of question. The other part is, do other states have that? Let me ask Diane to answer to this, that time she can.
Mr. Chair, Representative Junkie, I'm not aware of, you know, reading anything in the trade press about states that have it or don't. I do know the FCC does try to compile as much information as possible, but a lot of times they exempt the small providers from having to report. And I think our reason for raising it is that that is probably one of the questions we get asked the most is, who can I get broadband service from? I live in Wilmer. We don't we don't keep that information in part because we regulate Quest and Wilmer. We don't regulate their DSL offerings. The competitors that are there, again, we don't regulate their broadband offerings. So, you know, if we get questions about, well, you know, where is WiMAX available? That's a wireless offering. We don't regulate it. But people come to us thinking we have that information, and we don't.
All right. Thank you, Commissioner. Ms. Wells, President Hoppe.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And my apologies for being late. It will never happen again.
Well said.
And I apologize again for being late. I don't know if this has already been covered, but...
it has.
Thank you. You are an efficient and omniscient chair.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Commissioner Garvey, I wonder if you could, and maybe you've already done this. If you have, forget it. I will get it off the Internet. Can you just give us a thumbnail sketch of what's happening nationwide with the FCC and in other states and technology-wise in terms of competitiveness and new technologies and, you know, where the industry is going or industries are going, where the potentially the federal government is going? A lot of the things that we might do or might not do could be impacted by what the feds do or technology does. Take no more than a half an hour.
Mr. Chairman, Representative
Hoppe. And Commissioner.
I gave a very quick overview of the transition changes that are going on in wireless and high speed. I didn't really speak about what's happening at the federal level with any kind of specificity. And I'll let Ms. Wells handle that since she's more familiar with the docket set before the FCC.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Representative Hoppe. I think some of the hot-button issues at the FCC this year will probably be access reform. Right now, various types of technologies or carriers pay different rates to terminate calls when the function is the same, whether you're a long-distance carrier, a local carrier, or an ISP provider, and they are planning to move on that. They are having some discussions on net neutrality, which also may appear as an issue in Congress. The FCC is expected to act on some stricter customer proprietary network information rules, which is when telephone companies or providers can give out information on calling records. You might recall that that was a fairly hot button issue last year, and we do have a law on that that was passed here in Minnesota. The FCC is looking at reforming their Universal Service Fund. Right now, contributions are paid for long-distance calling, and they want to expand that. The percentage charge to fund that is getting high, and they want to spread it amount out, perhaps by a per-number fee charge, so that they get it from all types of providers. There is a move to digital TV, so they're working on that issue. They've completed a spectrum auction this summer. Those wireless providers will be using the new spectrum. And then there are issues with VoIP phone service, broadband-based phone service, and the fees that they pay. They're required to pay for 911 service. And there is a question of whether that will be expanded to, like, the TAM or the relay programs. So those are some of the issues.
Thank you very much. And I will add, Representative Hockey's identified a very important issue, obviously, at the national level. We do plan on, within the context of this group, spend a certain amount of time looking at that whole national umbrella and how it affects the state. Commissioner Garvey?
I have one more final thing. I know my time is run up, but I did save the best issue for last, sir, and that is the department has no legislative initiatives on the telecommunications side.
Okay, very good. Thank you for your testimony this morning. We're going to move at this time to hear from the PUC for some further testimony. Dr. Harrop, welcome to the committee this morning. You want to identify yourself for the record and proceed. You have about 20 minutes or so to try to...
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. My name is Burl Haar. I'm the Executive Secretary for the Minnesota Public Utilities Commission. With me this morning is Mark Oberlander, Mark is the manager of our telecommunications unit, and we hope to give you an overview of the telecom regulation in Minnesota and some of the issues that are in play presently. Before I do, and I'm going to rely on Mr. Oberlander to do most of that, by the way, but before I turn it over to him, I just want to make a couple of comments about the commission's role. I believe you heard from Commissioner Pugh yesterday on the structure of the commission and the role of the commission, so I'm not going to repeat all that, but I would just emphasize that you may recall the commission is primarily a decision-making body.
Let me just interrupt for a second, Dr. Hart. A lot of the members on this committee aren't on the the other committee, just so you're aware of that.
Right.
I think I might be the only one.
Perhaps then, I'm sorry, that was my misunderstanding then. Perhaps I could just take a minute then to talk about that.
Just so aware of that as you proceed.
Context. Thank you. The commission is primarily a decision-making body. It's comprised of five members appointed by the governor and confirmed by the Senate. It's deliberately structured to have a significant degree of decision-making independence, and because of that independence, it's also held to fairly specific and stringent standards of conduct. For example, it's deliberations and meetings must all be in public or subject to open meeting law. Decisions must be recorded in a written order where the rationale for the decision is clearly stated. The record must be based on record evidence, which is derived at through due process, rules of due process. Commission decisions are all subject to appeal to the Minnesota Court of Appeals. So, and there are other limitations and so on commissioner conduct that are designed to ensure the integrity of the commission's decision-making process. The commission has kind of three roles in state government. It's somewhat unique for state agencies. We're a quasi-judicial body. The commission is when it adjudicates party-to-party disputes or establishes rates or terms of services for a utility or telephone company or sets broad rules. It's operating in a quasi-judicial function. It also is quasi-legislative when it establishes broad policies for the industry, such as in its rulemaking mode. And also, it has powers of investigation. It has authority and does mediate consumer complaints and is responsible for enforcement statutes. So it has administrative duties as well. So it sort of touches on all three primary functions of government, really. With that brief background, I should mention that its primary function is that of decision-making body, and the commission relies to a significant degree on the input of parties, on all parties. We have an open process, and as I said, it's subject to fairly well-defined rules of due process. The advocates that come before us do a great job and help the commission build the record so that the commission can make a well-informed decision. The party with the responsibility to represent the broad public interest, the public advocates, is the Department of Commerce. You just heard from Deputy Commissioner Garvey. That's their role. They're a very, very significant player in the commission's process, and we rely a great deal on their advocacy representing the broad public interest before the commission. Also playing a very important role in that function is the Office of Attorney General. The Residential Utilities Division represents such smaller volume users, residential users, small business users, and they also intervene in many cases before the commission and provide valuable input. So those are the primary public advocacy bodies. Commission has its own telecom staff. It's smaller than the departments, but Mr. Oberlander is ahead of it, and we have five analysts. Their role is primarily advisory to the commission. They're not advocates. They're there to help the commissioners understand what's in the record, to understand the issues that are before them, to understand the positions of the various parties that on any given issue. So with that background, unless there are questions, I would refer over to Mr. Oberlander for an overview of the telecom.
Very good. Mr. Oberlander?
Good morning. I'd like to provide a little bit of information regarding the history and evolution of telecommunications regulation in Minnesota. And I'm going to be covering a lot of the same ground that Commissioner Garvey did, hopefully with a little different perspective or just a little additional information. As Mr. Garvey indicated, telecommunications started in the United States largely as a private enterprise. After the invention of the telephone, any person could build their own telephone system anywhere they wanted. They would buy the equipment and start providing service. So in Minnesota, somebody could put a switchboard in the corner grocery store or the feed mill and connect the 10 businesses in town. After some time, the farmer a mile outside of town, he would build a line into the switchboard so he could make a call. Then the farmer 2 miles out built the line. Then the farmer 3 miles built their line. So in this way, there were literally hundreds of telephone companies in Minnesota. And after each farmer stopped building their lines, that's where the telephone exchange boundaries were established. Because the telephone system needed a wire connection, it was a spoke and hub arrangement. So the two systems built until every farmer had a line. One farmer's line went east, one farmer's line went west, and their fence line between the two farmers is where the telephone exchange boundaries were set. So the telephone exchange boundaries don't follow county boundaries, they don't follow highways, they don't follow municipal boundaries. They're really an accident of history. So that just gives you a little idea of why we have over 600 telephone exchanges in Minnesota, and the boundaries don't seem to have any rhyme or reason. Here in the metro, we had multiple telephone companies. If you say you had telephone company A, B, and C, everyone who had service from telephone company A could talk to other customers of telephone company A. People getting telephone service from company B could talk to customers with their service from company B, but somebody on telephone company A couldn't make a call to somebody on telephone company B. The companies didn't want to cooperate because they each wanted to capture all of the customers. Also, in the large metropolitan areas, because you had multiple companies, that means you had 3, 4, and 5 sets of telephone poles going down the alley, 5 sets of lines going down the alleys. And as Commissioner Garvey indicated, after a period of time, this is roughly the 1930s, I think people said there's got to be a better way to do this. And I believe it was in 1934 that the federal government passed the law allowing local service monopolies. And that said, we're going to have one telephone company serve each local area. But in return for getting that government monopoly, you have to provide service to all customers. If a customer asks for service, you have to connect them. That was the original universal service idea. Everybody should have a phone. Everybody should be able to talk to everybody else in town. Also, because it was a monopoly, their level of earnings or profits were regulated. That's called rate of return regulation. We also had basic quality of service standards that every telephone company had to provide to every customer. So that monopoly regulation that had, you know, strong consumer protections, rate protections, and quality of service protections, That was the system we had in place roughly from the 1930s through the late 70s. As you were told earlier, because people could only get telephone service from one company, their choices of equipment and the kinds of lines they could get were limited as well. So there was a series of federal actions to help bring some additional benefits to callers. For example, the first element, a sort of a deregulation, the equipment, the telephone sets in your house were deregulated. You could go out to the store and decide what kind of telephone you wanted to hook up inside your home. The next step was to deregulate the telephone wiring inside your house. Once that was deregulated, you could change that wiring any way you wanted, but it was your responsibility if that telephone wiring broke. Just like if your electric wiring breaks, you call an electrician, you pay the electrician. If the telephone wiring in your house breaks, it's your responsibility to take care of that as well. Then moving along to the 1980s, as was earlier mentioned, there was the federal antitrust case, and the court decided that AT&T should divest or spin off the Bell local telephone companies, and that allowed companies like MCI and Sprint to provide, to start providing long distance service. So at that point, we have the introduction of competition in the long distance market, and that starts the struggle between two different kinds of ideas. One idea is to promote competition and the benefits competition can bring to consumers, but at the same time, it erodes the idea that all customers can get all services under the same terms and conditions. They're both good ideas, but they bring different sets of results for consumers. And when long distance competition was first introduced, the PUC did have to approve the rate changes for all long distance companies in Minnesota. But in 1993, the commission determined that long distance rates should be deregulated. The companies still have to file a request to provide service in the Minnesota with the PUC. The PUC grants a certificate of authority. They still have to file books containing their rates and conditions of service, but the long distance companies largely could set their own long distance rates. Then in 1995, the legislature decided that competition should be allowed in the local telephone business as well. And here's a case where the state of Minnesota was ahead of the federal move towards local competition. And the 1995 legislation it's not a total deregulation bill. It said that under the alternative form of regulation plans, the rates for basic services should be protected as much as possible, but in the more competitive areas, companies should be given more pricing flexibility or freedom, and the law spelled out different categories and criteria the commission should look at when deciding what services fell into what level of regulation. So that, by deregulating local service, you've now created a new category of companies. Sort of in the industry, we call it competitive local exchange carriers, but that's a new segment of the industry, where before you had one local, each customer had one local company. Now they can choose between the traditional local company or all of these new local companies that are offering their service. Then in 1996, the federal government eliminated the local monopoly on a nationwide basis. Okay. So we have been operating under this alternative form of regulation scheme ever since 1995, and that brings us sort of to where we are today. The traditional large landline telephone companies in Minnesota, and in Minnesota these are companies like Quest and Frontier and Embark, they have the option of being regulated under traditional rate of return regulation or being regulated under the state's large company alternative form of regulation statute. Then there's approximately 9 small traditional landline telephone companies. They have essentially the same choice to be regulated under traditional rate of return regulation or the small company A4 statute. The competitive local exchange carriers are regulated under a separate statute, that's 237.74. Their rates are largely deregulated, but they do have other obligations under the law. And it's the same with the competitive long distance carriers. They can largely set their own rates, but they have to follow other provisions in the law. There are a number of telecommunications services that are not regulated by the PUC. We do not regulate cellular or satellite TV service or any paging services. We don't regulate coin or public pay telephones. We don't regulate telephones in hotels or motels. We don't regulate any internet or any internet service providers, and we don't regulate any cable TV services. Then telephone calls can be made over digital systems. Because they're just digital computer signals, they can be sent over the internet. The FCC has ruled that the various state PUCs may not regulate telephone service that's provided over the internet. The Minnesota PUC was the first state in the nation to try and address this issue, and the PUC has appealed the FCC ruling to the 8th Circuit Court of Appeals. So the status of regulation of telephone calls over the computer or over the internet, that's not settled as a matter of law at this point. Telephone calls using these digital or computer systems, they can be transmitted over many different mediums. Those signals can go over copper lines. They can go over fiber optic lines. They can go over cable TV lines. They can even go over the electric power lines. So with you know, the advent of these digital and computerized systems, we're moving into an era that in many ways is like the conditions that existed when telephone service first started. There are many different systems out there that are not interconnected with each other on a technical basis, and there are a lot of competition issues to be worked out, you know, between the different segments of the industry. And when different segments of the industry tell you they're facing competition or there's a lot of competition in the telecommunications industry, there are different types of competition. Sometimes it's one long-distance company competing to get the long-distance business of another carrier. That might be called direct competition between two companies in the same business. There's also intermodal competition, where a landline, where a customer in one of your communities wants telephone service, they might decide, should I get a cell phone or should I get a landline? They can choose the technology they use to get their telephone service. And right now, telephone service is being sold by companies that want to provide additional services as well. Sometimes that's referred to as the triple play. Those services being voice telephone service, TV and video programming, and high-speed internet access. So the environment in which we're talking about telephone service today is not exclusive to the voice telephone industry. It's touching on several wider industry segments as well.
And there's just a few minutes left, Mr. Oberlander, for presentation.
Then the next and final thing I'd like to turn to, it's a very broad description of the PUC's telecommunications goals. As you can tell, you know, from the evolution of regulation and competition in Minnesota, it's turning into more and more of a balancing act. So in reaching its decisions, the commission must balance many goals in the cases that come before the commission. The commission has to be concerned about supporting universal telephone service, making sure everybody has telephone service available to them, maintaining just and reasonable rates. We want to make sure telephone service is affordable for all Minnesotans. We want to encourage economically efficient deployment of infrastructure. We want to encourage fair and reasonable competition in a competitively neutral manner. We want to maintain or improve quality of service. We need to promote customer choice. We need to ensure certain customer protections remain in place, and we need to encourage different members of the industry to try and work out their differences on a company-to-company basis and come to the commission only if they're not able to solve their differences between themselves. To touch a little bit on some of the topics that came up in the earlier discussion, there is a telephone statute that requires telephone companies to submit annual reports to the PUC and the Department of Commerce. Right now, that law basically says the telephone companies only have to provide their name, address, and contact telephone information. Years ago, the statute was broader. It basically said telephone companies must submit annual reports as the commission as the commission designated what information should be contained in the annual reports. So we used to get more information than we can collect today. If the legislature would restore that authority, then the commission would be able to solicit and require all companies to submit information that's determined to be important. And, Mr. Chair, that's the end of my prepared information.
All right. Thank you very much for that information. And if there's no further questions, I think we'll move on. Well, Representative Thiessen.
Just on that last point, two questions, I guess. Thank you, Mr. Chair. The first question is, would that just be for telephone companies, or would that be for, you couldn't get that information from the places, people you can't regulate, correct?
That's Overlander. The commission's basic jurisdiction is over telephone service providers. The basic state law says anyone who provides a telephone service to the public for hire, they are regulated by the PUC.
And Mr. Chair, and so that a circuit appeal could actually affect that jurisdiction if for the cable companies?
Mr. Overlander?
As was indicated, right now the status of telephone service provided over VoIP lines, that's just voice over the internet protocol, that is the issue that is under consideration in the Federal Court of Appeals. Depending on the court's outcome, the PUC will either be able to regulate that form of telephone service, or that will be excluded from the PUC's jurisdiction.
And one last, more of a comment maybe, but as we get into that issue, it would be helpful to know what use that information that you collect in the past was put to, so that we have a sense. I have a sense that there's probably a reason we changed the law as well. So I hope if we get into that, we can talk through kind of the right answer is there.
Very good. Thank you, Representative Thiessen. Any further questions from members? If not, thank you for your testimony, and we'll move on to our last testifiers from the Attorney General's office.
Good morning.
Good morning. Identify yourself for the record and move ahead.
My name is Jessica Palmer-Denig. I'm an Assistant Attorney General with Attorney General Swanson's office, and I manage the Residential and Small Business Utilities Division of the office. Mm-hmm. The Residential and Small Business Utilities Division is a little bit of an unwieldy title, so we abbreviate and just call it the RUD. The RUD has a statutory charge from this legislature to represent the interests of residential and small business utility ratepayers. Within the context of that representation, we appear before the Public Utilities Commission and the courts, and also here at the legislature to advocate for those folks in Minnesota. On top of those efforts in sort of the traditionally regulated areas that you've heard about from Deputy Commissioner Garvey and from the Dr. Haar and Mr. Overlander from the PUC, we also have a great deal to do with wireless, which is the subject that I want to talk with you about today. Now, before I get any further into my presentation, I'd like to identify for you Brian Bergson over here. He is actually going to wear two hats in the Attorney General's office. He is replacing Leslie Sandberg as our press secretary, and also Ken Peterson, who I know a lot of you probably had involvement with in the past from the legislative side. Brian's going to be our legislative director as well, because I know you'll see a lot of him going forward. I want to provide a point of clarification to Deputy Commissioner Garvey's presentation here today, which is relevant to the subject matter because I'm going to talk about wireless. There was a lot of discussion of the lack of authority to regulate wireless by the Department of Commerce and by the Public Utilities Commission. And the context for that is really found in federal law. The Federal Telecommunications Act prevents states from regulating the rates that wireless companies charge or their entry into the market. So wireless companies are not subject to the jurisdiction of the PUC for certificates of authority to provide service in Minnesota, and they also are not subject to rate regulation like a traditional telecom carrier under an A4 plan or under a rate of return regulation. The Federal Telecom Act also says, though, that states have the authority specifically reserved by Congress to regulate other terms and conditions of wireless service. and Congress specifically identified within the other terms and conditions consumer protection measures. So I want to be clear that the state does have authority to protect wireless consumers specifically reserved to them by Congress. Attorney General Swanson is proposing this session that the legislature enact wireless telephone consumer protection measures. The purpose of this bill would be to address particular problems that we're seeing from wireless consumers in the state of Minnesota, but also to avoid the areas that are federally preempted. And I want to give you a little bit of background so you can understand why Attorney General Swanson believes that regulation is necessary. More than 70% of Americans now subscribe to wireless service. Wireless phones are used by citizens of all age groups. I think a lot of us, when we have a picture in our minds of who's using a wireless phone, think of a 15-year-old girl who's text messaging her friends, and there's certainly a lot of that that's going on. But in fact, everyone uses cellular phones now, and I just read an article the other day that said that there are certain wireless phones and phone plans that are being specifically targeted at seniors. The phones that are being targeted to them are a little bit bigger than your standard wireless phone. It has a bigger key display on it, bigger buttons, so that the seniors can more easily see them as the eyesight wanes and maybe manipulate them if they get arthritis. So definitely this is an industry that's targeting all markets. It's also important to note that many people, and more every day, are deciding to use their cellular phones as their primary phone. They are foregoing landline service in favor of using a cell phone exclusively. This is much more common right now in some younger age demographics. Your pages might eventually find themselves in that segment. Certainly the 25 to 35 age range is particularly affected by that, but where they go often, so goes many others when it comes to technology. And then it's also important to note that cell phones are a really big deal for small businesses. Particularly when you think about people who don't have a traditional office, people who are in the trades, your craftsmen, your electricians, your plumbers, your painters, they're in their trucks all day long. Their cell phones really are the lifeline to their livelihood. And when problems arise for them, it's really serious, not only in terms of can they call their mother and, you know, find out if she's okay, but can they make appointments with clients? Can they get business so that they can support themselves and their families? Now, unfortunately, people are not very happy with their cellular phone service. Consumer Reports just came out with a survey last year that ranked the cell phone industry amongst the lowest of the industries that ranked. It was on par with computer tech support. During the last 4 years, the Better Business Bureau has ranked the wireless industry as the most complained about industry. Last 3 out of 4 years, the 1 year that it didn't rank as number one, it ranked as number two, and it was beaten out by auto dealers. And then on top of that, the Attorney General's Office has received literally thousands of complaints from Minnesota consumers who feel that they were treated unfairly by their wireless carriers. The Residential Utilities Division includes, on top of the lawyers who advocate on behalf of the utility ratepayers, a staff of mediators who mediate with the wireless companies and other regulated industries 3,000 to 4,000 complaints a year. We are the first line of defense for a lot of cell phone users when they have these problems. And our staff, we have discovered, consistently sees the same problems over and over again, year in, year out. And that's one of the reasons that we think that wireless regulation is really important. Now, this legislature also thought that wireless regulation was important, and it passed a bill in 2004 that regulated consumer protection in the context of wireless carriers. That 2004 legislation had as its primary component a provision that required wireless carriers to give notice to their customers and get their consent before they raised the price that they were charging or before they extended the length of the contract. Now remember, the Telecommunications Act says that we can't regulate the rate, and the wireless carriers believe this was rate regulation. They challenged it in the courts, and the Attorney General's Office successfully defended it at the trial court and the federal courts. But the wireless carriers appealed to the Eighth Circuit, and the Eighth Circuit held that the provision of the bill that imposed a 60-day window when the wireless carrier couldn't raise the rates until you had consented was a rate freeze, and that it constituted rate regulation. We had argued this was an other term or condition. We said, this doesn't actually regulate the rate. We don't care how much they charge. That's between them and the customer. We just want to make sure that there's notice and consent. We were supported ultimately ultimately the Eighth Circuit decided against us, and we had to appeal to the U.S. Supreme Court. And in our appeal, we were supported by 36 other state attorneys general. We were also supported by some national consumer protection organizations like AARP, the National Consumer Law Center, and Consumers Union. Unfortunately, the Supreme Court has a pretty heavy docket, and they declined to hear the case, which left the Eighth Circuit's decision in place, meaning that that statute was preempted by federal law and could not be enforced. What Attorney General Swanson is proposing is a replacement statute for the one that was enacted in 2004 that addresses the consumer protection problems but completely leaves alone the rate regulation side of things. We don't want to run into the same preemption challenge again. The bill would do a number of different things. First, it would require some disclosures at the time that you get your wireless contract. These are pretty simple things. We want you to know what the price is. We want you to know where your phone is and is not going to work. If you have a cabin up north and your primary purpose is that you want your phone to work at your cabin, and in reality this wireless carrier doesn't provide service up there, that's probably not the phone for you. You might want to go somewhere else. We think that wireless carriers should have to clearly disclose to you if the contract allows them to change the terms in the middle of it without your consent. We want you to know that at the outset. And we also want you to know whether or not there are any termination fees that will apply if you decide to cancel your contract. Most of these contracts are two-year contracts at this point, and that's a really long time. So if you're going to have to pay $150 to get out, we think that's really important. And we also think it's important that the wireless carrier be required to give you a copy of the contract. Ultimately, if you do have a dispute with your wireless carrier down the road and they're going to hold you to the terms of it, we want to make sure you have a copy of that document so that you can see what it says. We've run into complaints with certain wireless carriers where they say to the customer, well, your contract requires this, and the customer says, well, I'd like to see a copy of it. And the wireless carrier says, well, we don't actually have a copy of it, but your contract requires this, and we're not going to let you out. So we want to make sure there's a copy of it out there for you to see. After your contract is in place and the wireless company is billing you, that's the second part of the bill. We'd like to have the wireless carrier have some disclosures that are required on the bill. First, we think that charges for the wireless service itself and charges for government taxes and fees should be listed separately so that you know what the actual service is costing. We ran into problems a couple of years ago where some wireless carriers would put extra little charges on and they would label them as if they were government taxes and fees, but really they weren't. And we want to be clear with consumers about what that is. And we feel pretty strong about this provision, partially because the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals has just upheld this as being not rate regulation. So we feel pretty safe on that side. We also think that we should extend to wireless carriers a provision of law that currently applies to local phone carriers that restricts their ability to put charges for other third parties on your bill. Right now, there's a provision of Minnesota law that requires local phone carriers to make sure that you have third-party verifications or other verification before they can put the third-party charge on your bill. If you dispute a charge that's on your bill, they have to go to the third party and get a copy of the verification. And then if there's no verification or it's not adequately verified, the telephone carrier, which is who you have your primary relationship with, is required to refund charges to you for 6 months back.
Just let me interrupt for a second. We just have a few minutes left, Ms. Palmer.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any other kind of umbrella issues at the AG's office, might be a good time to...
Mm-hmm.
to bring that up, because I'm sure we'll have the opportunity
sure.
to look more directly at the bill you're talking
sure.
about down
this
the line.
Is really, I believe that this is Attorney General Swanson's primary bill that would be appearing before this committee. I think
okay.
that she believes this is very important, and so I think this is something that's really getting a lot of emphasis.
Very good. Finish up, proceed.
Sure. There's just actually one more provision of the bill that I wanted to mention. There would be a requirement that the modification of the 2004 bill that would require wireless carriers, if you're going to add a phone or extra minutes or some other new service, and that's going to extend your contract or put you into a new contract, they just have to tell you. We're not going to say they can't do it. We just think that they should tell you. And this is something that we continue to receive new complaints about. I think we got 3 or 4 new complaints this week alone from people who said that this had happened to them. So to close up, we really believe that this is pretty simple, common sense protection. To be honest with you, these are things that I think wireless carriers really should be doing anyway. And sometimes they come and meet with me and they say it's our official policy to do these things. And they represent good business sense. If you treat your customers well, obviously they're going to be happy and they're going to stay with you. And it is a competitive environment. Unfortunately, the fact that we continue to receive these complaints year after year on the very same subject suggests to me that no matter what good intentions they have, ultimately on the ground level, the consumers are not getting the protection that they need and that this is really important.
First time junkie, do you have a question?
Just back to the subject of information that various people can provide. You know, I don't want specifics now, but as you say, complaints come in. Will you be able to share with this committee if they're broad brush with most carriers in the state or if there's certain one or two names that always rise to the top so that we can focus a little bit on maybe certain companies' practices as we go through some of this legislation? Is that available to us?
Ms. Palmer? There are some restrictions under the Data Practices Act. The Attorney General's Office complaint data is considered private data. I can sometimes provide summary data upon request. I could certainly summarize, you know, the kinds of complaints that we're getting. What I think I need to emphasize, though, is while there are some carriers that at times generate more complaints than others, what we are seeing are consistent broad brush across the board problems that people are experiencing with all carriers.
And Representative Hockey?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'll be brief. Just generally, isn't a lot of stuff kind of common sense things that people should check for themselves? For example, if I buy a new cell phone and I'm planning to use it in my cabin, I would ask if it's going to work there rather than get it and find out it doesn't work there and then complain.
Palmer?
Ideally, certainly that is true. I think that the problem becomes when the wireless companies put out their coverage maps, these are advertising material, and they obviously want to have the, I mean, I'm not going to say specifically that there is false advertising going on, but there are certainly people who have complained to us that the coverage map they were showed at when they got their cell phone contract ultimately was not accurate as to where they got it. And then with respect particularly to the contract extension, when you call to add a couple extra minutes to your phone service, they're specifically not telling you that you're getting into a new contract. There have been people who have been on month-to-month contracts because they originally had a contract. It ended. They're on a month-to-month with their carrier. They don't think they're under a traditional contract anymore. They go to add a few more minutes. Something's wrong with the phone. They go back to complain to the carrier about it, and the carrier says, oh, you're in a two-year contract, and they never knew that they were getting to. They never signed anything. They never agreed to it. So that's the problem that we're seeing, and it's pretty common.
Any further questions this morning? If not, I thank you for your testimony.
Thank you.
And members, as we close out today's meeting, we'll be hearing testimony from some other interested parties over the next week and probably next 2 weeks. So you'll be informed of the forthcoming agenda, and I think it'll be very enlightening. It's obviously a rich and complex area that I think we'll enjoy tackling. Again, thank you for being here, and we'll see you next Friday morning. Meeting's adjourned.